Good morning. Our reading today is from Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 through 23. Now, when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that?" Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and do not let their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward, and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. In Judah, it was said, "The strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall." And our enemies said, "They will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work." At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, "You must return to us." So the lowest parts of the space behind the wall in open places, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." When our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon in the other. And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me, and I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, "The work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. In the place where you hear the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we labored at the work. Half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. I also said to the people at that time, "Let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day." So neither I, nor my brothers, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Thanks, Giselle. When Becca and I were living in Boston, helping plant a church, I decided that to meet people in our neighborhood, I was going to join the running club. We were doing an annual race together. We were running up this hill that felt like it had no end to it. And right about the moment that I started to think, you know, maybe joining the running club wasn't the way that God was calling me to share the gospel with my neighbors, somebody just zips past me and says, "Man, this thing's easy, right? It's no Heartbreak Hill." Thank you. Heartbreak Hill, if you don't know what that is a half-mile hill at mile 20 of the Boston Marathon that is infamous for discouraging, defeating, disgracing the best runners from the goal they woke up to that morning. I know that you probably have experienced something like that in your life before. I'm sure you know what it feels like to throw yourself into something and then run into some really hard resistance, some opposition. And maybe not just from a hill in a race, opposition from a neighbor, a family member, a coworker. Opposition that can start to fill us with fear, doubt, distraction. Maybe even from the things God's called us to. Well, Nehemiah knows exactly what that feels like. And Nehemiah is the wine taster to the richest man in the world. He's living 1,000 miles away from Jerusalem, the city that God's put at the crossroads of the ancient world to be the place where God's people living under God's promises, love to God's glory. The only problem is for the last 140 years, it's been a ghost town. And God calls Nehemiah to do the impossible. Risk it all to rebuild a broken city and a broken people. So Nehemiah goes. He leaves Persia. He gets to Jerusalem. He surveys the ruins. He makes a plan. And as we saw last week, everyone buys in, picks up a shovel, and gets to work. I mean, if this is Nehemiah, the Netflix movie, the montage starts rolling right now with inspiring music going on in the background. Everything's looking great. Now reality starts setting in. This is going to be hard. Harder than they ever imagined. There's people who don't want this city rebuilt, who don't want this people rebuilt. Sanballat and Tobiah and other people surrounding Jerusalem, they get in their face and they start opposing what they're doing. They try to stir up fear, doubt, distraction, to get in between Nehemiah and his calling to build up the people of God in the grace of God for the good of the world. And guys, even though the scenery has changed, that story is still unfolding with us. You know, today, the place where God's people live under God's promises and love to God's glory, it's the church. It's us. And just like Nehemiah faced opposition, so will we. You know, Jesus in John 15 said, a servant isn't greater than his master. If they oppose me, they'll oppose you too. Now, Jesus isn't saying there, wear opposition like a badge of honor. Provoke people to oppose you. Let people oppose you for the wrong reasons. But he is saying, don't be surprised. There will be people who won't like the gospel, who won't like God's irrepressible commitment to redeem to himself undeserving people through his unconditional grace by the unimaginable work of his son, Jesus. There's going to be people outside the church who aren't going to like that. There's going to be people inside the church who aren't going to like that. I mean, some of you really know what this is like. You've lived or done ministry in parts of the world where Christians are under intense opposition, unlike anything that we know of here in Orlando. But regardless of where we live, if you belong to Jesus, we will all ultimately run into opposition. Because as Paul says in Ephesians 6, Our struggle ultimately isn't against flesh and blood, but a spiritual enemy, Satan, who loves to stir up fear, doubt, distraction from the calling that Jesus has put before us of renewing the church from the ground up in the lavish love of God in the gospel. So how do we respond? How do we respond when we run into opposition? Well, Nehemiah shows us three things that we're going to look at. We run to the promises of God. We remember the protection of God. And then we rebuild in the power of God. So first, we run to the promises of God. Picture it in your mind here. Everyone's shoulder to shoulder. They're hard at work when in verse 1, Sanballat, the governor of Samaria next door, hears about what they're doing, and it says he's angry and greatly enraged, right? This is someone who despite what maybe they outwardly project, inwardly they're insecure, they're afraid, and in verse 2, he just explodes with one insult after another. What are these feeble Jews doing? Don't they know they're too weak for this? Will they restore it by themselves? Anyone can see this is a terrible plan. Will they sacrifice? Are they just going to pray the wall back together? Will they finish in a day? Do they have any idea what they're getting into? Will they revive the stones out of heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? Don't they know what they're using is ugly and useless? How could worthless, burnt out stones showcase a great and glorious God? Now, we all know the power of words, don't we? Mariah Carey once said, at the peak of her success, she said, you know, I can hear 1,000 praises and one criticism, and the criticism will overrule the praises. We all know how easily words can turn to weapons and do real harm. And that's what's happening here. I mean, Sanballat is an internet troll. He's trying to shame them into quitting. I mean, what's underneath everything he's saying here? God's plan is hopeless. God's people are useless. Nehemiah, you and your friends are like those burned out stones. You're useless. Have you ever felt that way before? Useless. Like maybe Jesus needs to go out and get better building materials than me. How could I showcase the glory of God? I feel that way some days. And if you ever have too, just hold on to that thought. Because we're going to see in a little bit what God loves to do with burned over stones. Nehemiah's insulted, he's provoked, and so how does he respond? He prays. He says, "Hear, O God, for we're despised. Turn back their taunt on their heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover up their guilt. Do not let their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they've provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." I mean, Nehemiah here, he's mocked. He's got fingers pointed in his face. And you see what he doesn't do? He doesn't go on a Twitter rant or start an insult campaign. He doesn't try to get even or take revenge or win at their game. No, his knee-jerk reaction is to take it to God. He prays a prayer that's honest because he knows God can take it. And a prayer that's ultimately birthed out of his faith in the gospel, because Nehemiah knows these people, they're ultimately not opposing him. They're opposing God. See, Sanballat and Tobiah, that they aren't personal enemies, political enemies. They're enemies to God's promises. And Nehemiah is trying to rebuild the city that he says in chapter 1 is the place God stamped his name, the city at the four corners of the ancient world that God chose to reveal himself as the Lord, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Anybody getting in the way of that is getting in the way of God's plans of grace for a fallen world. And so what does Nehemiah do? Nehemiah runs to the promises of God. He says, this is wrong. This isn't right. Don't let them get away with this. Don't let them get in between all that you've promised. Don't let them stop you blessing a broken world in love. Because when we come across moments of real opposition to the gospel, opposition to renewing the church in the grace of God for the good of the world, a spiritual opposition that can hurt, Nehemiah is giving us a gift here by showing us how to hold together two things at the same time. An honesty that can say, God, this isn't right. Don't let this situation get in the way of the beauty and glory of your gospel being seen. While at the same time, trusting the outcome of that situation to God. Of not taking matters into our own hands, of not fighting fire with fire, but of putting matters into God's hands. Of running to the promises of God and trusting him to work in his own way. So when we run into opposition to what God's called us to in the gospel, we run to the promises of God. And then second, we remember the protection of God. The wall's half built. In verse 6, the work's getting hard. The people, they're weak. They're powerless. They're vulnerable. And they start feeling the pressure of opposition. They're surrounded and starting to fear. It's not just Sanballat in the north and Tobiah in the east, but now in verse 7, it's also the Arabs in the south and the Ashdite, it's in the west. All of them, it says, start plotting to come together and fight against Jerusalem. And they're tired and starting to doubt. They say in verse 10, there's too much rubble. By ourselves, we'll not be able to rebuild this wall. Can we really finish this? I mean, it is sweaty, messy work with huge rocks and charred rubble. How are we going to finish this? And they're anxious and starting to get distracted. The people who lived closest to the threats in verse 12, 10 times over, come to Nehemiah and ask him to take people off of the construction site to protect them instead. I mean, it is piling up here. It is one after another. It is piling up high on Nehemiah. If you're him, what do you say? What do you do? Nehemiah tells him in verse 14, do not be afraid. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. And so starting in verse 16, Nehemiah makes a plan. They'll work in shifts. Half will guard, half will build. The people that have to go the farthest out to the most dangerous places will carry a sword in their hand. The people that are close by who are just working on the wall will carry a sword in their belt. When you hear the sound of the trumpet, everybody run to the sound. I mean, it's a good plan. It is way better than one that I could come up with. But Nehemiah, guys, he's not trusting in the plan before him, but the God above him, who he says in verse 20, will fight for us. And that changes everything. You know, I was in high school, I played volleyball because when you're tall and thin, as my left shin bone found out, contact sports aren't always your best friend. And one summer, the summer of my senior year of high school, I played in a semi-pro beach tournament with one of my high school teammates. We were good for 17-year-olds. We were getting absolutely crushed by grown men, some of who played in professional tournaments. And towards the end of the day, my partner got hurt. He couldn't go on. And I thought, oh, thank God. We don't have to keep playing anymore. And then someone said to me, hey, there's actually a guy who's willing to hop in and help you finish your last couple matches. Turns out this guy played 15 years of professional beach volleyball, was hands down the best player in that place at that moment, and suddenly my whole mood shifted. I couldn't wait to get out there and play because it didn't matter who was standing on the other side of that net. They didn't stand a chance against the guy who was standing next to me. And I had one strategy. His name was Jim Nichols. Get Jim the ball and get out of the way. You know, Nehemiah knows that they've got someone standing next to them. It doesn't matter who the opposition is. They don't stand a chance against. And so he says, remember. Remember the great and awesome God who fights for us. You know what one of the most repeated commands in the Old Testament is? Remember. Because as I once heard the president of a seminary say, the Christian life is 20% event, 80% perspective. That there is so much in life that we can't control. But what we can steward through the work of the Spirit in our lives is our awareness of God in the midst of it. That when we run into opposition, when we run into spiritual opposition to the calling of renewing the church for the glory of Jesus, we remember we are never alone. No, we have a God who fights for us. You know, some of us know deeply what it's like to feel alone, to feel like no one will fight for me. Maybe that makes you feel defeated, discouraged, powerless. That those lies Satan's whispering, they probably are true. Maybe I really am useless. Maybe I really am just a burned over stone. Maybe God's glory really can't be shown through me. Or maybe you think, no one's gonna fight for me, so I gotta fight for myself. I've gotta take matters into my own hands. I've got to deflect the pointed fingers of our spiritual enemy through my good record, through my performance-based spirituality. There's always a chink in the armor, though, isn't there? And all the while we do that, the background music of fear, doubt, distraction just gets turned up louder and louder and louder. Until we remember. Remember the great and awesome God who loves to fight for us. So when we run into opposition in the work God's calling us to, of, of renewing the church to live in love for the glory of Jesus, for the good of the world. We run to the promises of God. We remember the protection of God. And then, guys, we rebuild in the power of God. Nehemiah, at this point, he's faced wave after wave of opposition. I mean, everything they could throw at him. And after all of that, Nehemiah writes in verse 23, "So neither I, nor my brothers, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand." After all of that, the opposition for Nehemiah, it doesn't stop. In fact, it only ratchets up in chapters 5 and chapter 6 until we get all the way to the very end of the book. And who's there being the biggest thorn in Nehemiah's side still? Tobiah. You see, Nehemiah here, he's not showing us how to get rid of opposition, but how to keep rebuilding through opposition. Because for people like Nehemiah and you and me, who are all living somewhere between the first two chapters and the last two chapters of God's big and beautiful story, we will always run into opposition. But we have a power that can help us to not lose heart in whatever we're facing. A power that comes in Jesus. You see, Jesus, he knows exactly what it's like to run hard into opposition in the work that God's called you to. Jesus was born facing opposition. He fled to Egypt to save his life. He heard the voice of Satan trying to stir up in him fear, doubt, distraction, saying, "Okay, Jesus, if you're the Son of God, turn these stones to bread. Jump off that temple. Bow down and worship me. Stop what you're doing. Get down from that cross." Where Jesus, just like the people here in Nehemiah, weak, vulnerable, surrounded, took our place, endured the mocking, the pointed fingers, and stayed because his heart cracks open wide for harassed and helpless people. And there, hanging on the cross, Jesus fought for us, fought for you. And as Colossians 2 says, defeated Satan, sin, and death, putting to open shame the things that try to shame us. Jesus, who gave all that he is for all that we need freely and forever when he died, not just to defeat the enemy outside of us, but also the one inside of us, when with a love too great to be limited by what we deserve, Jesus said on behalf of us, "Father, cover up their sins, blot out their guilt by blotting out me instead." And then he rose with all authority and is declaring today over all creation, "I'm building my church and the gates of hell will never prevail against me. No, I'm gonna reign until there's no enemy left, and by grace, I'm sharing that victory with you." But as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 16, soon, soon, Jesus will crush Satan under our feet. I mean, who hasn't endured enough sin, enough shame, enough evil to not want to get in on that? See, guys, just like Sanballat, Satan's a mouthy enemy because, as Revelation 12 says, he knows he's a defeated enemy whose time is short. And when, like Sanballat and Tobiah, Satan gets in our ear saying, "You're just a burnt out stone. God can't use you. God can't show his glory through you. God can't renew his church through you. You've got too much sin, too much shame, too much suffering, too much self-righteousness. Jesus says, oh, but you forgot. I love bringing burned stones back to life. In fact, it's all he's got to work with, and it's his glory. You are his glory. He's not embarrassed for one second about the building materials he's got to work with. He calls you precious stones. When Jesus wants to blow a raspberry to Satan, he just points at his church and says, man, look at them. Aren't they great? And he doesn't have an ounce of worry about the task before us, just a heart that can hardly contain the unbridled joy of watching his church renewed in the power of his love and wave after wave of the gracious work of his Spirit. And guys, this is how we rebuild and renew in the power of God through opposition. It's as we see and we adore and we worship Jesus, who fought for us, who fought for you, not with a sword in his hand, but nails, and is fighting for you now. Let's pray. Jesus, you promised in this world we will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world. Jesus, in this life we do have trouble. It's hard. And so we are so thankful that the one who is in us by grace is greater than the one who is in the world. Jesus, I pray for these friends this morning, that in the opposition that we run into, and our spiritual enemy Satan, who would love to stir up fear and doubt and distraction from us throwing ourselves in to living and loving for your glory and the good of our world, I pray that you would help us to remember the God who fought for us on the cross and is fighting for us now.